Auden. Someone must save this sweet raven-haired maiden. You are tuned to WBFY LP Belfast, Maine, 100.9 FM.
Support for Belfast Community Radio comes from our listeners and from the Old Professor's Bookshop, a Harvard Square bookstore in downtown Maine, featuring a unique selection of scholarly and rare new and used books, located at 99 Main Street, open 10 to 4 most days.
See, you got the TV fixed.
No, it just fixed itself.
Girl, nothing in this world fixes itself.
You know she's right. Nothing in this world does fix itself. That's why WBFY is looking for volunteers with technical skills to help with computer and audio equipment. Of course, we'd love to have more DJs and fundraisers and that kind of thing, but the technical crew, there's the elite. Please get in touch. Send a message to info@belfastcommunityradio.org.
Welcome to Books and Writers, the show for writers, aspiring writers, and anyone fascinated with creative writing. I'm your host, Spencer Stevens. On Books and Writers, we'll talk with those who know writing as both an art and as a science, who know how to make writing work, how to get it noticed, how to find inspiration, and how to avoid ruts and get out of them. We'll discuss habits, habitats, and brains of writers, editors, publicists, book bloggers, bookstore owners, publishers, and others. We'll talk about the books that should have succeeded but didn't. We'll talk about the writers who broke the rules and succeeded anyway. We'll look at books in progress. We'll lead you to becoming a better writer, or at least to a deeper appreciation of your favorite writers. This week on Books and Writers, our guest is Maine author Nancy Freund Bills, whose memoir, The Red Ribbon, recounts her family's struggle after a 1994 lightning strike that killed her husband and badly injured one of her sons. The book is a series of essays describing various phases of her experiences and her emotional reactions to them. The Red Ribbon won a coveted starred review from Kirkus Reviews. One of the book's essays, The Myth, took first place in the memoir personal essay category of the 83rd Annual Writer's Digest Writing Competition. Nancy has a master's degree in 20th century English from the University of Rochester and a bachelor's in social work from the University of Connecticut. She teaches creative writing at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at the University of Southern Maine in Portland. She's had nonfiction, memoir pieces, and short stories published in a variety of outlets, including Reflections, The Maine Review, The LLI Review, The Goose River Anthology, and in the 83rd Annual Writer's Digest Writing Competition Collection. We talked to Nancy about her experiences, how they sparked her interest in writing and served as a platform to a career in writing and teaching writing. Nancy lives in Southern Maine. Our guest today on Books and Writers is Nancy Bills, author of The Red Ribbon, a memoir of her experiences and thoughts in the wake of a tragic lightning strike that took the life of her husband and nearly killed her son, who managed to recover. Nancy, welcome. I'm very happy to have you here as a guest and looking forward to chatting with you about your book.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. Nancy, let's talk about your writing experiences, the earliest ones. As a young adult, or even as a youngster, was writing part of your life?
Oh, that's a funny question. And I can tell you that when I was in the sixth grade, I wrote a mystery called, I try to remember exactly what it was, but I would have been like 12 years old, and I wrote this mystery about a murder in a kidney-shaped swimming pool. So I guess it was there from the beginning.
Interesting. It sounds like you had an imagination and you had a willingness to put it on paper, and you even had some visuals to go with you. You had details like the kidney-shaped pool. That's a promising start, it sounds like.
well, I didn't get much of a chance to do creative writing during my education. I was an English major as an undergraduate, but that meant mostly reading, and that was certainly a valuable background for me to have. I was exposed, you know, to classics and very good contemporary novels. And then when I was doing my first graduate degree, it was at the University of Rochester, and I did a project about 20th century of literature and art, and I just had that was, I think, the most fun I ever had and the most freedom I ever had as a student.
Interesting. Other than your story about, you did your story about the murder in the kidney-shaped pool. You did some writing, it sounds like, in graduate school. Were there any other ventures into the creative writing area before you sat down for the first time and began putting together the pieces that became the Red Ribbon?
Well, I think I need to share that my work life, the work that you know, that put bread on the table, was working as a social worker. I have a master's as a licensed social worker, and I work both in private practice, but also in at Maine Medical Center on their locked psychiatric unit, and in Concord, New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And although you wouldn't think that I would have had much of a chance to write, I was given a compliment by one of the psychiatrists that I worked with, who said that my patient notes, the charting that I did, was so valuable, and that he always knew from my writing what was going on in a case. And he said that it read like a story. So kind of an odd thing to realize, but that was my outlet, I think, for many years, was to write about my patients, who sometimes were very fascinating.
I've heard from a lot of writers that at various points along the way, many of them unexpected, that they received praise or encouragement from folks who saw their writing and said good things about it. It sounds like you had that experience as well.
I did.
That's
yes.
That's wonderful. I backing up for a moment, the murder in the kidney-shaped pool still has me captivated. Did you ever do anything with that story? Did you share it with friends and family? Did it go anywhere?
Teacher, and she probably made some corrections because she was that kind of a lady, and I had a very nice male teacher as a sixth grader, and I'm sure he was encouraging, but it's funny to think about that, to think, you know, that when you were so young, you were still having creative and imaginative things going on in your mind.
Absolutely. I think one of the most creative periods for most folks is childhood and adolescence. So many ideas come to mind, partly because you have relatively limited connections with the limits that are waiting to be put upon you. You don't know what you can't do. And I've often found that successful writers are folks who had some sign, some motivation related to writing early in life. And it sounds like you fit the pattern. You're one of those folks. That's nice to hear.
Yeah.
Let's fast forward. I know that it was in July of 1994 that the terrible accident occurred that took the life of your husband, Jeff, and the badly injured your son, Teddy, the name that you gave to those fellas in your book. And how long after that event did you begin to think about writing down ideas or notes that might become what we know now as the Red Ribbon?
It was probably 5 or 6 years later that I settled on the idea that I had an experience that was worthy of being written about. And I thought that I had the courage to write about it. And I certainly wanted to involve both of my sons, and see if they wanted to have some input. And I needed information from both of them. And I just checked. The first classes that I took were at the University of Southern Maine. I had a wonderful professor named Diane Benedict, and I took several memoir classes with her. And then she invited me to be part of a private workshop that she ran. It was an odd experience to be one of the oldest people in the class, because most of my fellow students at the university were in their 20s or young 30s, and I was somewhat apprehensive about sharing my work, but they were very encouraging. And one spring, we were all approached and asked to choose someone from our class to do a reading at the end of the year at a celebration. And we each put somebody's name down and said what we thought was good about their writing. And I had written, the piece that I had written is in the book. It's the first piece that I wrote, and it's called The Emptying and the Filling of the Drawer. And it's about my son Josh, who is my younger son, and his construction of a sculpture. And I had shared that that piece with the members of the class, the young women and the young men, and they all chose me to represent the class. And I was so moved and so proud, and I don't think I'll ever forget how thrilling that was.
So more encouragement, signs that your writing was catching attention and gaining favor. People recognized something good in you. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And some of the young men said, that they, because we would sit in a circle and I would read, we would read our stories to one another. And he said, tears were streaming down my cheeks, he said. So I knew that I had the potential to be a writer, and that I could put together sentences and paragraphs that would move people, that would touch their hearts, and that was terribly exciting.
I'm sure. To be able to move people with your written words is a great thing. It's the whole essence of the show and our consideration of writers. It must have been a terrific moment when you saw evidence that you had that ability.
Yes, it was.
This study that you're talking about at the University of Southern Maine, was this part of the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute?
No, it was not. The classes that I was was just talking about were just, you know, regular classes that freshmen or sophomore at the university would have been taking. And it was a couple of years until I learned about Ollie, which is at the University of Southern Maine. It's, I believe, the first of about 100 Ollies all across the country. And it was funded by the Osher family and is for anyone who over 55 who wants to go back and take classes. They're usually taught by people who were previously professors or had considerable training in a field, a wide variety of classes, history and art and drama and literature. And I began taking classes at Ollie and really settled in there.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I'm curious. A lot of our listeners are writers in various phases of their development. I'm sure some of them are considering classes and seminars and workshops. I'm wondering if you can recall the things that you learned from your formal study of writing that stood out as especially helpful.
One of the things that I would say is that it's important to find a teacher or a facilitator who you feel really comfortable with and a group of people who are genuinely trying to be helpful so that their feedback is really valuable. And that, I think, was maybe one of the first lessons that I needed to learn, and that was when I got feedback, I really needed to listen to it and take it to heart, even if occasionally I didn't like what the person was saying. And now that I've been facilitating the fiction workshop at Ollie, that's what I say to my writers, is that even if you initially resist what someone is saying, to try to find, give yourself a little time, and maybe they're saying something that is important to listen to. As a teacher, I try to be very encouraging and to recognize that my students are on a learning curve and that my feedback needs to reflect where they are and what they need at that moment.
Mm-hmm. I have heard from many writers, and I know this true from my own experience, that being part of a community of writers, especially those who have time and ability to read your material in early drafts and give feedback, is crucially important. It sounds like you found that community at the University of Southern Maine. That was your writers group.
It was. I was very lucky that the woman who was probably the most formative of my writing while I was at Ollie is named Ruth Story, and she's no longer teaching there, but she taught many memoir classes. She taught Pulitzer Prize winning novel classes, and then she led a memoir workshop. And I took every writing class that she offered, and then I also took writing classes from a wonderful man named Tim Baer, the leader of the fiction writing group and the poetry writing group has become a good friend. Her name is Jenny Morton. And I participated in all those different workshops, even the poetry workshop, not because I thought I was going to write poetry, although I did. But I wanted to experiment with language. And yesterday I read the first part of my book, and I thought, wow, that participation in poetry, in the poetry workshop, even though the other members were, I thought of them as real poets, that was so valuable for me in terms of you know, putting words together and, yes.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And so it sounds like your philosophy was find a good teacher and learn everything I can about every kind of writing I can. You went at it with a very open approach and what some folks call divergent thinking, and went looking for inspiration and influence in every area where you could get it.
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
Excellent.
Yes.
In your book, The Red Ribbon, there was a bunch of poetry, and I'm wondering if you had not taken the poetry class through the folks at the University of Southern Maine, would that poetry have ended up in your book, do you think?
No, really with everything that is in my book, I would write a rough draft, and then I would write a revision, and then I would do rewrites, and that was especially true of the poetry where, I remember, just throwing chunks of things that I wrote out, and I'd have ideas and images. You probably read some of the parts of the book that are about dreams. So there's a lot of imagery, but the poetry didn't come easily for me. But as I go back and read it now, I think, well, that's not too bad.
That's a true test of writing, I think, is when you can go back years later and look at it and decide it wasn't too bad. You might have been doing a pretty good job. That's a very gratifying moment right there.
It is.
And since writing the Red Ribbon, you have graduated to becoming a writing teacher at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, which folks call OLLI. Is that correct?
Yes, that is. And for the last 7 years, I've co-facilitated the group. It's a group of 12 writers, pretty much the same folks, and the woman that I co-facilitate with is a good friend, and we work well together. It helps me. I use the skills that I learned when I was a therapist and I was running workshops for, I'd be running workshops for patients who were going to be discharged, and you wouldn't think that running those groups would help, but it was still running a group, and I've been determined as the facilitator, the person who really runs the group, that everyone would get a fair share of time and attention, and that no one would get as though they had worked hard on a piece. They wanted to share it, but they didn't. There was no time for them, and so we even have a timekeeper, and she will wave her hand and say, you know, like 1 minute to go, and then we all know that we need to whatever feedback we have, we need to share it, and then I'll be the one who will say, well, and now let's move on to so-and-so, and would you please read a few paragraphs of your work? And it's a model that that I created, really putting together all of the things from groups I'd been in that I'd liked and throwing out a few things that I didn't like, frankly.
It sounds like the way you teach, it resembles the method that you felt like you benefited from most as a student, which is using a class as a vehicle for getting feedback to the individual students in the class, basically creating a writer's group for your students. Am I gauging that correctly?
Yes, you are. And occasionally, very occasionally, I'll notice that several people in the group are struggling with the same thing, and you know, it may even be something as simple as grammar, and then I'll say, I'm going to take a couple of minutes and just review something that I think, you know, that I want to share. And then I'll notice they all pick up their pencils and, you know, or pens and start writing down whatever it is that I'm sharing. But I think the way I teach is I don't really teach until there's a need for something specific. And I know that they're going to be able to receive it because that's where they are in their progress.
You're constantly on the lookout for a learning opportunity, it sounds like.
I am.
That's
I
good.
Am.
That sounds
yeah.
excellent. I'm curious, you've been teaching for a while, you've been working with groups, and you probably have seen some patterns in how students respond to receiving criticism and input in a writer's group setting. What are the hardest parts about that for most students, and how do they overcome them generally?
Well, I can tell you about one of my students, a man, and I won't tell you his name, but if he ever listens to this interview, he'll know it's him.
He'll be glad you didn't say his name, I'm sure.
He was a history teacher and a really lovely fellow, and started writing fiction, but the young fellow in his book, I think, is based very heavily on himself and his adventures as a young boy. And when he first started writing, there was no white space. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It was all narration.
Yep.
And barely a paragraph break. And I was getting feedback from other folks in the group, and they were saying, it was hard to read his work. And then my co-facilitator said, you know, there's no dialogue in here. It's just narration. And so I thought, oh gosh. He had created a delightful character. He was using material from his own life, you know, so a lot of things good were happening, but we needed somehow to boost him into trying out dialogue, and When we first made the suggestion, he was not happy. He was, he was writing the way he was writing, and that's what he wanted to do.
He was resisting change, you're saying.
He was.
Yeah.
And we all do that. It's hard to take in what feels like criticism, even when it's, very well meant and, well targeted. But he got around to it. And it's probably been 3 or 4 years now. But he writes dialogue beautifully now. And his work is a balance of narration and dialogue. And if you look at a page of his work, there's white space, and it's very inviting. And he's, he can laugh about it now, and he's very proud of that kind of progress.
That's wonderful. I have been a member of a writer's group for about 10 years, and I will confess that at the beginning, it was very difficult to accept criticism and to not try to argue people out of their ideas. It was so important to listen and to take notes and to not discourage anybody from pursuing a particular line of thought by trying to tell them how wrong they were, but instead trying to stay open to the idea that maybe they're right, maybe I'm doing it wrong, and maybe I should be willing to reconsider my habits and my strongly held beliefs. That's a tough hurdle for a lot of students, I would imagine.
It is. It's hard. And I think the only way, well, certainly the way it works in my experience, is if you know in your heart that the people in the group care about you, and that whatever they say is well meant and carefully considered. We begin the year each time talking about, what kind of criticism, feedback works, and what we need to be, careful of, and to treat other people with respect and kindness,
sure,
basically.
Sure.
Yeah.
Having taught for quite a few years and having worked with big groups of students, I'm tempted to ask, I will ask, do you see any link between formal education and writing ability? Are those two necessarily linked, or should people toss off the idea that they have to have a college degree in order to be able to be good writers?
Oh, that's a tough one. let me tell you about a formula or a theory that I have. I believe that to write successfully, first you need a subject, a worthy subject. And then you need to have the courage, the personal courage to attack whatever the subject is. And it may be, it may even be a pretty humble kind of subject, your experiences in your family, what it was like growing up. But I'm getting kind of some beeps on my phone. Is everything all right on your end?
Yeah, we're fine over here. I don't hear the beeps.
Okay, good. And so, first it's that subject you need, and then it's the courage. And then it really is the skills, and I guess I could say whether the skills, like the grammatical skills, come from formal education, or whether they, come from like individual study, going back and reading, doing a lot of reading, which is maybe the most valuable thing I think that a writer needs to do. The reason that I took all those writing classes was that I felt I genuinely wanted to improve my skills, and I just, you know, I just worked and worked, and had to be willing to throw things out. We're teased writers that our work is like our children, and that, you know, throwing them out is painful, and it is.
But in terms of writing ability, in terms of capacity for producing good writing, a person doesn't need to have a college degree. That was sort of where I was going with my question.
I don't believe so. Yeah. No.
Okay.
No. And there are lots of different ways to take writing classes. I didn't mention it, but before I took the classes at the university, I took some adult education classes, which were very inexpensive. The university used to have a continuing education series that they offered at night. And so a person who has an interest in writing could join a group at their local library. You know, there are all kinds of ways to go at it.
Sure. Moving to the Red Ribbon for a minute, I'm wondering, the pieces that make up the Red Ribbon, they're essays and poems, generally speaking. Were those run through the review process in your classes? Did you use that process as a source of feedback and criticism?
Yes. The answer is yes. Every single piece was written. Many of them were written for a particular class. We had 8 weeks to write a piece, and I would do the best I could. In 8 weeks, it would still be pretty rough around the edges. And then I would do rewrites, and then maybe put it away for 6 months or a year, or sometimes even longer, and then get it out. And by then, I would have learned, for instance, to interject some smells and some tastes and some sensory content, and, you know, so I'd add bits and pieces. And and there are some pieces that early on it was really painful to write. Sometimes I'd actually be crying. Sometimes I'd be laughing, kind of laughing at myself. But every single piece was workshopped, and the first chapter, I would say, is the one that just got a tremendous amount of attention, probably the most attention.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I wanted it to just be, perfect is the right word, but I wanted it to be my best.
Sure.
In writing.
Sure. It sounds like you are among the many writers who believes that lots of editing, lots of comments from readers is the best way to polish a piece and get it to where you're happy with it.
I do.
Yeah.
I do believe that.
Yeah, I've been pleasantly surprised at how many writers, some very successful, who have said the same thing. I would have imagined that some of the luminaries in our area might have reached the point where they could write without having to seek out editing, but I don't think that person is very common if they exist at all. Tell me about the dreams that you used in The Red Ribbon. It seems like a lot of your writing relates to dreams, and I'm curious what your thinking was and about wanting to include dreams so often in your book.
Well, I hesitated, frankly. I had written some dream pieces that I liked, but I didn't know if they worked for other people, and I those are pieces that I would have that I came close to throwing out, not including,
mm-hmm.
And I'm glad I did include them, but it was it was a little risk. Not everybody's cup of tea.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure what the dreams meant. I thought, oh dear, what if somebody is a Jungian psychoanalyst and a dream specialist, and they read my book and they think, oh, Nancy didn't know what she was saying or what she was doing. So I thought I better figure out what I was, what the dreams meant, so that I didn't have anything too, too self-revealing in my book, if you know what I mean.
Oh, I know exactly what you mean. I think when you, if you write something that relates to your personal experience, by sharing it with folks, you are revealing certain parts of yourself, and you have to be comfortable with the idea that folks might judge you or evaluate you somehow. And for most of us, that's not an easy process.
No.
Yeah.
No. That's true.
I would imagine that writing about dreams that relate to the loss of a loved one, it must have been somewhat like therapy. There must have been some therapeutic aspect to it. Would that be correct?
Oh, I think so. In fact, I would say the writing of the book was very therapeutic for me, and the publishing of the book, the sharing of the book with the with kind of a larger audience, and then going to libraries and reading the book. My teacher Ruth Story arranged for me to do a reading at the university to a group of nurses and nurses' aides, and I can't tell you which piece I read to them, but I know that when it was over, they came out and they wanted to hug me. And they had tears in their eyes, and they wanted to touch me, and they wanted to tell me how moved they had been, and I was so moved. It was another one of those times that, I remember where I was standing, and I can almost feel their hugs. So yes, writing can be very therapeutic.
And not just writing, but sharing it with folks as well. It sounds like that was some therapy also. Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm curious about some of the details of the lightning strike used as the focus of your book. As we mentioned, the lightning strike took the life of your husband, and it spared your son, even though it hit him and left him temporarily dizzied and badly injured. Have you ever been able to figure out why it was that two people standing so close together had such different outcomes?
Well, I think the answer is no. my husband and my son were both badly hurt. I think it may have been my son's age that may have been the factor that made the difference. But when there's a chapter where I can't remember exactly which one it is, but I talk about the rescue, you know, the rescue people, and I don't know if I mentioned in the acknowledgments, but there were actually two brothers who had been playing. He'd been having hamburgers and potato chips and playing croquet not far from the bunker that was hit by the lightning. And the people who had been picnicking at the park at Fort Foster just ran to their cars. And, of course, a car is a really safe place to be in a lightning storm. It turns out that a concrete bunker is not a safe place to be.
Mm-hmm. Especially if it has metal bars inside of the concrete.
Especially if it has steel bars.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay.
But I think that at the time my husband was very fit. He was a marathon runner, and he was only 48. But I believe that he. As I said in the chapter called The Myth, I believe that he would have made the choice to be the one. You know, if one of them had to die, I think he would have. He wouldn't have hesitated to be the one. And I believe on some, you know, in some, I suppose, kind of a romantic way that. That he saved our son.
Yeah, yeah. The description of events in that particular item, the fact that your husband was lost and your son was saved, it sort of struck me as the kind of random difference that leaves many of us searching for meaning. And I seem to pick that up in your writing. Is that am I seeing that correctly?
Difficulty hearing you. Is it possible that our connection has deteriorated? And do you think that perhaps you could call me back?
Oh, sure. Can you hear me now? Is it still a problem?
I think I'd like to. Does it work for you to call me back? Is that possible?
Yes. So we were talking about the randomness of death and the difficult sense of searching that might follow a confrontation with that, and it seemed to me that a lot of the emotion going through your book was along those lines. It looked and felt that way. I'm curious to see if that was correct.
Well, I think. Last night I reread the chapter The Myth, and I think it's probably the most powerful chapter in the book, probably also the most beautifully written in terms of you know, the parts of it that read like poetry, but it's the chapter that I'm also, I think, the most proud of. It's that conversion, what, you know, of taking kind of raw emotion and converting it into art, converting it into you know, something beautiful.
Mm-hmm. As I was reading the myth, which is basically a conversation with your late husband, or as you say in the essay, consultation with a ghost, it was very powerful, and it seems from the awards that you've received, the myth was perhaps the best received of those chapters. Did you have any sense that that was going to be the case as you were writing it?
I think perhaps I did. I knew certainly with the very first chapter, I knew how critical that chapter was.
Yeah.
But when I got to the myth, and of course when I arranged the chapters, I put the myth, it's really right smack dab in the middle of the book. And the reader discovers when they read the myth, they get to the end of that chapter, and that is when I explain the reason for the title of the book.
Yep.
And I thought, I thought my reader might think, oh my gosh, you know, now I understand the title. And, it's kind of like when you're reading a mystery and you want to know how things are going to end. In this case, the mystery is, well, what in the world does the red ribbon mean? It seems like at the outset, kind of an unusual title. But then when you get to the end of the myth, the reader has, that is like a little surprise.
Yeah, yeah.
So I did that on purpose.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I thought it was a nice touch. When I got to that part of your book and I realized the reason for the title, I felt like I had been enlightened somehow. It was a nice discovery.
Good.
That's
what it's supposed to be.
Good. There were several descriptions in the book about your late husband peering out of the slit in the concrete bunker, and I'll explain for the sake of the listeners that the lightning strike happened in an old World War I bunker that had been left behind, and that your husband and son apparently sought shelter in when the lightning struck. And there's many descriptions in the book of your husband peering out the slit of the concrete bunker, and I was left with the idea that that might be your image of him, your lasting image. Is that true?
Well, there are two images. One of them is that slit, and of course, in my visits to Fort Foster, I've been in the bunker, and I've even stood there, saying prayers. But the other image is the image that the picnickers talked about, and that was, they said they looked up the hill and they saw a man holding on to a railing, and it was at that moment that they believed the lightning struck.
Yeah.
So it's like there are these two different images. One is of my husband and my son inside, with my husband, being the one who kind of blocks the lightning as it comes flying across the sky. And then the other one is that he's on the kind of the opposite side of the bunker. He would have been outside of the bunker and holding on to the railing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I guess I play around with both of those images.
Sure. Back to the myth for just a minute. The essence of the myth is your conversation with your late husband. You realize as you write that he cannot speak back to you. And I was recalling many pieces of literature and film that involved people who imagined or found a way to communicate with a lost loved one. That theme seems to be a very popular one, very evocative, and I'm wondering if you were thinking about that as you organized the myth, or was it just circumstance that happened to be the structure of your essay?
I don't think I thought about that.
Okay. It was just good fortune that you stumbled upon a theme that resonated so well with folks.
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
And you know, and some of the things that happen when you write are happy accidents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent. Nancy, I'm curious, are you still active writing these days? Is that part of your life?
Oh, I am. I have a feeling that when I'm an old woman and can hardly do anything else, I'll still be writing. I'm working right now on a kind of a love story, a happy ending story. But my two main characters are going to suffer many traumas and some deaths before they get to a happy ending.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like an exciting and ambitious project. This is fiction.
This is fiction.
Very nice. Okay, and it sounds like it might take the form of a novel.
Well, I would say I'm thinking of it as a long, short story, and maybe that helps me be able to write it. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, I wrote The Red Ribbon just a little bit by little bit, and most of the chapters, you probably didn't even realize it, but most of the chapters are about 1,000 words or 1,500 words. Not long.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the way I like to write, is not, you know, not too much at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of weave things together, and then of course I take into consideration everything that my fellow writers tell me.
Sure.
And they always have lots of feedback.
Oh yeah. It sounds like that you might have learned something about your style of writing when you wrote The Red Ribbon, and that it's worked its way into the writing that has come since then. Is that a correct assessment?
Yes. I think this is just going to be the way I work. And I think it's the way a number of writers work.
Mm-hmm.
There's a woman named Anne Lamott, I think that's the right name.
Sure, I'm familiar with Anne's work.
Who wrote a book called Bird by Bird. And my teacher, Ruth Story, was often offering her up as a model. And it made me feel like my writing style was okay.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody else who was an expert could, you know, if their concept was writing bird by bird, then mine being writing bit by bit was pretty close.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one of the nice things about writing, I've always thought, is that you can do it any darn way you want to, and that's just fine. It's one of these art forms that has relatively few limits on the artist.
Exactly.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah.
Well, Nancy Bills, author of The Red Ribbon, is our guest today. Nancy, I want to thank you so much for sharing with us so much of your time and your insight. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. I hope to finish The Red Ribbon this weekend. I read about 2/3 of it before our interview today and am enjoying it immensely. Thank you so much for putting together such a wonderful book.
Well, thank you for inviting me to be your guest. And it's been delightful talking to you.